The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, what am I going to talk about? I've got a couple of things that I want to try and mesh together, and in my head it makes sense. So hopefully, by the time I've just blurbed it all out, we get somewhere sensible. But I wanted to talk about how banks create money, what the implications are for you actually owning anything, given the implications of that. And then I kind of had a few thoughts on tech and geopolitics that I wanted to mesh together. So not entirely certain what I'm going to call this episode yet, but hopefully once I've got it all out there, it will actually tie together quite nicely. At least it did in my head when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about. So first of all, let's talk about how banks create money, because We've touched on this a couple of times, but we haven't quite got into the sheer duplicitous horror of how it actually works. So basically, banks create money out of credit creation. So we have a debt-based system. You know, I've talked about that, but the actual process is quite disturbing, because look, you don't actually deposit money with a bank. I know you may think that you deposit money into your bank, but really you don't. What you do is you are lending money to your bank. It is legally their money the moment it's in their hands. And if you go down to your bank and you hand them a bunch of cash, you have now become a general creditor to that bank. That money that you've just given to them is now fully owned and controlled legally by that bank. You're just now a general creditor, one of its customers. You know, alongside if you have a small business, if you've got a general creditor, you know, the plumber, the landlord, whoever it is, you've got a bunch of general creditors. That's basically the status of somebody putting money into a bank. I mean, there's some nuances around it, but that's essentially where you are. So banks don't take deposits, which a lot of people will find surprising, but it's actually true. Also, banks don't actually lend money. They purchase securities. Now, that's the bit that will really get people, I know, on this. So when you go to a bank and you ask for a loan, what they don't do is they don't go to somebody else's deposits, because as we talked about, there are no deposits. But they don't go to another pot of cash anywhere, take some of that and then loan it to you, which is how people think banking works. Actually, what they do is they purchase from you a promissory note. You know, a bit like you know, Bank of England note is a promissory note. You know, a promise to pay the bearer on demand and so on. Even though that's become disentangled these days. But essentially, what they're doing is they are purchasing a loan contract from you. Right? Sounds surprising, doesn't it? So what happens is the bank, let's say you go to the bank, right? And you want to buy a house. So you want to borrow 300 grand from the bank. What they actually do in that instance is the bank will purchase from you a loan contract for 300 grand, right? So that becomes a bank asset, which they call a customer deposit, although no one has ever actually deposited the other side of it. You know, that money is not transferred from anywhere inside or outside the bank. That money is basically created at this point. So, you know, they create the money, they record the asset of you now are going to be paying them a stream of revenues from this. They owe you the 300 grand, which is made available, which you then presumably buy the house with and is transferred off somewhere else. That is how money is created. Now, I did find, and this is what prompted me to bring this up, a really good video that explains this from the Monetary Institute. So there's a guy on a short video, it's about a 15-minute video, Professor Richard Warner, who actually I'd love to get him on Brokenomics. I must reach out to him, which talks about the sources of money creation. So I'm going to put that link in the reading list, and he basically explains this process very well. So if you want a fuller explanation of the bit that I just said, by all means, go and check out that 15-minute video and he'll get into it in a little bit more depth. But it is worth thinking about the implications of this process of how money is actually created, how money is basically loaned into existence, how money, all money is debt. So contrary to, again, a lot of what people might assume about the banking system is central banks or governments don't really create much of the money. They can create money. They can create the sort of base money. They can create the sort of currency level money. But actually, something like 97% of all money is created by private banks through this credit creation process. Central banks, you know, create the other 3%. Now, during lockdowns, of course, they kind of created a lot more than that, or technically they didn't. It was liquidity, but we will come back to that bit. So the implications of this are huge because, of course, when you create money through this debt mechanism, so all money is debt, debt is created and money is created along with it. So essentially, actually, where is the money? What is the true point of money creation in this process? Okay, the true point of money creation could be argued it's when you start paying off your loan. That's effectively when money is created. Or when the money that the was created in that loan process is then shipped off to whoever bought your house and they start spending it. That's effectively when the money creation process takes place. But of course, with that debt that has just been created to create this money to purchase the loan agreement from you, which has then gone off and entered the economy finally, and then you create the money when you pay it back. On top of that debt, you've got the interest, right? This is where it gets interesting because, of course, just stop and think through that process. All money is created as debt. Well, almost all money is created as debt. And the interest is on top of that. So what does that mean? Does that mean that you could ever pay off the debt? Well, no, because there isn't enough money to pay off all of the debt plus all of the interest, because all of the money is the debt and then the interest is on top of that. So you see what I mean? You have to continually increase the amount of money, actually debt in this process, in order that you can pay off the interest on the money that you've already created. So you can see that we are in a process and have been in a process since the creation of fiat money, where you've basically locked yourself into a process where you have to continually expand, you have to continually inflate. Inflation is, and I'm using the term inflation here to imply the perceived effect of inflation. So the prices, basically your money buying you less every year. So prices going up. You've designed a system where inflation is very, very much a feature and not a bug of this process. Although, actually, to give him his credit, the good professor I mentioned earlier makes an argument which I will lay out, which is why it need not necessarily be that case. I mean, it has been that case. It has observed to be that case. But I'll present the other side of why it potentially doesn't have to be that one. So central banks are, I think since 2008, have started to see some of the issues with this and where they would like to do things differently, because they've started to acknowledge that, yes, central banks are basically more think of them as the coachman on an old-fashioned coach wagon with the four horses in front. And they've got the two reins, and the two reins are basically, you know, interest rates and money supply, which they can affect through quantitative easing or other methods like that, sort of liquidity measures. But it's really the horses at the front that are driving this entire process. What the central banks are talking about increasingly, and this is something which I should probably do another Brokenomics on now that we're getting a bit deeper into this stuff, because I did do a Brokenomics on CBDCs, but I think now we've developed this concept enough between us that we can probably take that to sort of the next level. What the central banks are actively talking about now is that they want to take that money creation process that I've just laid out to you away from commercial banks, which are currently creating the money, and basically take it entirely into their hands. So they would create all of the money, as well as control all the money and be able to turn off transactions or block transactions to people they don't like as they say fit. Now, if this were to happen, and they're kind of running full steam towards it, and you know, the EU, for example, is very much behind the European Central Bank in order to get this done, because of course it shifts power away from national governments to them. The process a little bit is coming up against more friction in, say, the US, for example. If they were to achieve this, this would make the events of 1913, when the Federal Reserve was created, look like just the start. It would be the biggest transfer of power and control to the elites that I think we've ever seen. I mean, it would be a crippling blow to all freedoms. Right. So given that this is our system, okay, it is imperative that the way that this money gets created gets deployed right, okay? Because if we are going to have a system where money is created on this sort of continually expanding basis, think about debt. What really is debt? Debt is you're moving consumption from the future into today. So you're saying that, you know, I'm going to take, because if I take out a loan for £1,000 today, I immediately get £1,000, but I have to pay that back over a series of events going off into the future. So basically what debt is you're taking money from the future and giving it to yourself today, that you then have to pay off in the future. Now, is that a good idea? Well, as we talked about in some of the earlier episodes of Brokenomics, when we talked about debt, it can be. So let's say, for example, and I think the example I gave in that Brokenomics was, let's say you were a farmer. You're a young farmer, you've just come out of farming college, you've got the skills, you've got the energy, you've got the passion, but what you don't have is a farm and any farm equipment. If you pull money out of the future, that's perfectly sensible, because that young farmer, all they can really do is work in a shop because they don't have any capital behind them. If you can pull money out of the future and you can say, I'm going to take a big loan now, I'm going to purchase a farm and I'm going to purchase farming equipment, what that basically enables you to do is then start earning at a significantly higher rate. It dramatically increases your productivity, and therefore you can then pay off that loan in the future, having put yourself on a better future path. Okay, so if banks are creating all of this money, this is our money supply mechanism. Where does that money go? Let me give you a couple of examples as to how it can go. So it can go into consumption. So you can borrow money, and instead of investing it in your future, in raising your productivity and raising your ability to earn, you can basically consume it. You could go out and you could buy a car. You could spend it on a holiday. You could just live the high life for a while. What does that give you? Well, it doesn't give you any additional earning power into the future. It doesn't give any growth, any improved prospects. Now, this is basically the model that government are doing. So governments are borrowing money all of the time. And if you look at the biggest line items, and we talked about this in Brokenomics before as well, as to the biggest items that governments are spending their money on, it's all present day consumption. So it's basically healthcare, so Medicare, Medicaid, or the NHS here in the UK, or whatever country you're watching this in. It is pensions. It's war. That's another big one that they like. But it's social security or welfare. So basically, all of the government spending at the moment is focused around which is triggering them to make their borrowing. is all based around consumption. The other one, which is more relevant to this banking issue, is that it goes on asset bubble stuff. So it goes on asset purchases. This is particularly the case, by the way, in the UK. So we have a small number of banks. You know, what have we got? We've got like Lloyds, Barclays, HSBC, and you know, whatever, a couple more, Santander. So we've got a small number of, I think we've got five banks. And when you look at where their money, the money that they're creating, where is it going? It's mostly going to mortgages. So it's mostly going to property. Again, that is not making anyone more productive. It's not, because you know, you buy a house, but it doesn't increase your ability to earn. It just basically gets you something which is, you know, necessary to live in, and then you go off to learn or to acquire a set of skills or whatever it is. The other version that we saw quite strongly over the COVID era was the new money creation going into assets like the stock market or crypto. And that's also very dangerous in this system. Because it leads to high volatility. Why is high volatility such a problem in this case? Well, let's say we have a situation where assets are pushed up, and these assets are the collateral in the system, in the financial system. So equity values or asset values are pushed up 300%, and then they contract 10%. Well, now the system is bust, because there was a, you know, if there's a reserve requirement of 10%, well, even though it's gone up 300%, it doesn't matter. It's now contracted 10% off the high, and you know, your system is now bust. So volatility becomes dangerous in this. And again, what you're basically doing is you're impoverishing your future, because you're simply spending or consuming or pushing up a limited amount of stuff, essentially. You're not creating additional stuff in the future. So what would be the good form of this? What would this look like if this system is being deployed properly? And this is by no means what is actually happening. The correct way of employing this process, if you were to get it right, would be that this money creation would be going to raise future productivity. So it would be loans would be available to small businesses, medium-sized businesses, SMEs, businesses or individuals who were employing that money so that they could increase their output in some way, so they could become more productive in the future. Simply not what is happening. This is a million miles away from where we are now, but that is the argument as to why people feel that they want to keep trying to tinker with the system that we have, and why you could even find people who are quite sensible on economics who are suspicious of something like my favorite idea, which is going to something like gold or Bitcoin, because those are a very hard money standard, and the amount of money is inelastic and it doesn't respond well to financial conditions. Whereas with the banking system, it could. It's just not being used right, is the argument. My argument is that these people will never employ this tool correctly, because the incentives to pervert it is always so strong that will always be taken. Therefore, I prefer the definite negatives of a hard money system over an elastic money system such as this. But to give them their dues, I just want to explain to you how they feel it could be done. So they would argue that, okay, if this money creation machine was directed, instead of always going to assets, so the stock market or property, it was, you know, sent to people who were acquiring additional skills or opening a business, all that kind of thing, then it would be worthwhile. Now, so you might ask, okay, well, why isn't that the case? Why don't we just do that? Well, instead of, you know, lurching around from periods of damaging inflation and asset bubbles, and you know, why don't we just have that high productivity growth by investing it to people who are going to do more in the future? The main problem is because you need to remove a whole series of biases and self-interests from the system, which is almost impossible to do. And also you need sort of almost godlike central planners at the central bank who recognize where the winners of the future are going to be and back them. Which I don't think they're going to do. So, I mean, the USSR did this whole process. They just did it very badly. Western central banks, I mean, they're essentially doing much the same thing. They're fundamentally doing the same thing. They're fundamentally still central planners. It's just like instead of the way that USSR did it, which is to plan every aspect of the economy, the central planners in our system are just trying to get better and better at how they direct the money around the system, which is the other half of every transaction. So it's an improvement on the process that the USSR did, but not much of one, because we're still controlling, like I say, the other half of every transaction, which is the transaction side, the money side, the liquidity of it. Okay. So let's weave in quantitative easing to this, because I often in shorthand form refer to the events of 2020, the QE that happened then, and the QE that happened after 2008, the great financial crisis. I often refer to quantitative easing as money printing. And I wanted to tie it into that process that I described at the beginning of this. Now we're getting a little bit more nuanced about how the money is actually created. So the purists will get upset with me when I say that QE is money printing, because the real money printing is, well, there's the literal money printing, which is that 3% that central banks do, which is the creation of actual physical cash and a few other items like that. And then the 97%, which is the money created, or, you know, you could get away with calling that money printing, that the commercial banks do. Oh, incidentally, let me throw in there one point that just that comes to mind is Paul Krugman sometimes argues that the government should just print or mint a trillion-dollar coin or several trillion-dollar coins, and get themselves out of any sort of spending hole that they happen to be in. So this is—he's basically just saying, you know, this would be just pure money creation. So I had to throw that in because he has some particularly loopy ideas, and he's basically wrong about everything. But nevertheless, he has a Nobel Prize in trade theory, so we're all supposed to go Paul Krugman. Anyway, so no, quantitative easing. Why do purists say get upset when we refer to quantitative easing as money printing? They say no, it's liquidity. Well, because what quantitative easing actually does is it's a slightly different process. What it is the bank goes out and buys a whole bunch of securities from the banks. Typically government bonds, that's mostly what they do, although they can buy mortgage-backed securities, they can buy whatever they want, really. And when they do that, they basically, that money, again, is not transferred from anywhere else. They don't go and get it, borrow it, or get it from government, or save up for it, anything like that. It's just they create that money within the central bank's own account, and then they go off. And of course, if it's just in the central bank's account, you know, that doesn't influence anything. But what they immediately then do is go and buy a whole bunch of, say, government bonds from big commercial banks, so that their balance sheet has now increased. I think it's the for example, the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has gone from, it was 3, maybe 4 before lockdowns. It's now at something like 9 trillion. So it's more than doubled in size since lockdowns, which was the moment of great liquidity. So they sort of pull these government securities in from the market and swap them out with money. So the purists like to say, well, okay, well, that's not, if you haven't actually created money, what you've done is you've created liquidity, because this is still, if you were to add up all of the money type stuff and include near money substitutes such as government bonds, which are traded, you know, you still come to the same amount in total. But what you've done is you've exchanged something which was not particularly liquid, which is those long dated government securities, government debt effectively. You exchanged them for liquid cash. So you've injected liquidity into the system. And I tend to push back on that and say, well, okay, yes, you might be technically right, it's liquidity rather than money creation. But it's a distinction without a difference, because that money does go out into the real world. It filters out into an increase and very immediately of asset price inflation. And it does that for a couple of reasons, and I'll explain the mechanism. We start to get a little bit deeper into the process here. So how does it push up those asset prices? Well, firstly, because the banks now have a little more liquidity and they can deploy it as they wish. But actually, the bigger effect is that because the central bank has bought in a whole load of debt. Do you remember how in the episode before last I talked about how the price of a bond is inverse to its yield? So, if something, a £100 bond paying £5 a year has got a 5% yield. But if you halve the price, so the price goes down, it's still paying, so it's now worth £50, but it's still paying out £5 a year in yield. Well, now the yield is gone up from 5% to 10% because the price and the yield, that they move inverse to each other. So if the central bank goes out and buys a whole load of debt, lots of buying of those things is going to suppress the price of it because there's a big buyer in it. It's going to increase the price because you're taking a lot of those off the market. So you're creating a big demand for those securities, and because you're increasing the demand for those securities, and the price is going up, you're decreasing the yield on it. Right? Why is that important? Well, that's important because governments are now able to issue additional debt at a lower yield, at a lower cost to them, which is very important for governments which are as indebted as our governments are, which is a lot of what happened in 2020. They had a good excuse, which was the lockdowns, to inject a massive amount of liquidity into the markets. It suppressed the yields on bonds because they were buying up so many bonds, taking them off of the market. So the prices rose on them, the yields went down. And it then enabled governments to get out of the sticky position that they were in, but they needed to issue a large amount of debt. So they were able to issue that debt at fantastically low rates, which makes the massive surpluses that they're running, particularly through the COVID era, much more viable than they would have been. They wouldn't have been wanting to pay high rates for the period they did. The other thing that this does by suppressing those yields on bonds, the other effect that it has on asset prices is that it lowers the risk premium against which assets are judged, okay? So let me explain what I mean by that. If you're an investor and you want to put money aside for a long time, the book of theory says, that financial theory is, that you can have a risk-free rate, okay? And the risk-free rate is the rate of government debt. I think that's becoming less and less true over time, but okay, fine, that's what the book says. Therefore, if you are going to make any investment which is not government debt, supposedly the safest type of investment that you can get, what you need is a risk premium on top of whatever you can get for government debt. Okay, so let's say government debt is trading at 2% and you're going to invest in something which is slightly more risky than government debt. So let's say you're going to invest in the bonds of an established company like Apple. Well, you're not going to accept a yield that's less than 2% because that's what you can get for no risk. So if you're going to take almost no risk of Apple, you're still going to want that 2% plus a tiny little bit more because it's Apple, not the government. And if you're going to buy bonds in something much more risky, some tech startup, then you would want 2% plus a bigger risk premium on top of it. Maybe you want 3%, 4%, 5%, whatever it is to buy those. And the same process applies to when you are looking at shares, other asset classes. Basically, you're going to want to look at the flow of income that is coming from that in the future, and you're going to want to discount it by the risk-free rate plus whatever risk premium that you put on top. And that's particularly the case in high growth tech. A good example of high growth tech is going to be something like Tesla, where they are investing very considerably in gigafactories, in energy tech, in, you know, Optimus robots and self-drive and all those kind of things. So potentially the future income stream is incredibly high, but they are stretched out a long way into the future. So if you've got that long stretch of income out into the future, if you have low rates or the rates are moving lower, then what's happening is you are discounting those future income streams by a smaller amount, and therefore the stock becomes more valuable, which is why, part of the reason, I mean, there were other factors behind it, which is why Tesla had such a massive run-up. In fact, all of these sort of tech-like stocks, they had this massive run-up in the beginning of 2020 because the interest rates were being pushed down, therefore lowering the risk premium on long duration tech and other things like that. So all assets rose over the 2020 period, but it was tech stocks that did especially well out of it, which is why I invested so heavily in Tesla in 2020. As soon as I saw that this process was happening, that they were injecting a huge amount of liquidity in the process, that it was going to push down yields on the risk-free rate effectively, that here was a company which I liked anyway because I liked the fundamentals of it, I could see that future discounted stream was going to get even cheaper. It just became such a screaming buy. And to my immense frustration, I just sort of rang everybody I knew and sort of begged them to get their money into the market. But they were basically thought I was all mad because, every time you turned on the news, what you saw was, lockdowns, COVID is going to kill us all, chaos and all the rest of it. But what I was seeing was liquidity being injected into the market, and the second order effects was going to be the knockdown of the risk-free rate and the debasement of the currency and so on.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.